From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. What do a golf tournament, the Grand Prix, and electronic music all have in common? They'll be in Detroit the same week next year.
When you look at the audiences for those events, clearly it's not kind of the standard, you know, typical Detroit resident.
Also, the future for dairy farmers in Michigan is uncertain.
And really in the last 15, 20 years, it started to take hold, and therefore people can produce a lot more milk with fewer cows.
We'll talk about the impact of a changing industry on the individual.
And I see farmers out in the field well after dark, sometimes at midnight, with lights on their tractors, trying to harvest or trying to plant. I see milk barns lit up at 2 in the morning as people are trying to do that third milking. And so it's very difficult.
The future for milk in Michigan, coming up on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Well, you may have heard the circus is in town. The Democratic candidates for president are in Detroit for two nights of debates on CNN. And the week of organized chaos might just prove to be good practice for one week next year that's getting a bit, shall we say, overbooked. The Rocket Mortgage Classic PGA Golf Tournament announced it will now be held the week after Memorial Day, which just happens to be the same week as the Grand Prix on Belle Isle. That's also the week before the North American International Auto Show will launch for the first time in the spring. Oh, and that's also the week that many business leaders from Michigan head to the Mackinac Policy Conference.
There is no title of this song, let me tell you what's...
And did I mention that the Detroit Electronic Music Festival will have just wrapped up? So is this poor planning or a boon to the city? Kim Trent is an opinion writer from the city of Detroit. She's also on the Wayne State Board of Governors, and she joins me now. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Laura. So great to be here with you again.
So what do you make of the convergence of all these events happening at the same time next year?
Well, I think, you know, obviously when you have a signature event like the ones that are all going to be happening at the same time, you know, it's already kind of stressful because you're looking at a limited market, or, you know, you usually have a niche market for some of these events that are coming together. But with, you know, particularly when you talk about the Rocket Mortgage Classic and the Grand Prix and the Mackinac Policy Conference, all of those things kind of draw the same people.
Right.
So the challenge is going to be trying to find people from outside of Metro Detroit who want to come for this event. So I think that they're going to have to be really strategic about attracting either, you know, car racing fans or golfing fans. And then Mackinac, you know, that's probably a pretty solid audience because they're going there for business. And,
right,
you know, the people who go are probably going to still go. But those other two, I think, are going to be fighting for their lives.
Well, not to beat around the bush, but as you said, you know, a lot of these events, they attract the same kind of people. And it's hard for me not to think they all attract a lot of white people. And this is coming into a city that is 80% black population. I just feel like, what do you make of that incongruous atmosphere?
Right. I mean, there's certainly... you know, when you look at the audiences for those events, clearly it's not kind of the standard, you know, typical Detroit resident for both of those events. I think that it's good to have national attention for Detroit and some of the growth that we've seen. Certainly, yeah. I grew up in the Palmer Park area, and, you know, we saw with the Rocket Mortgage Classic how the city definitely spruced up, you know, some areas around the Detroit Golf Club. And so to the extent that having a national audience will help the city be more strategic about investing in kind of the corridors that get you to that club,
mm-hmm.
I'm happy about it.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, certainly I don't think the actual events are touching the lives on a daily basis of the people who live and work in Detroit necessarily.
But if they're coming into the city and plan on exploiting it for a space for their event, should they be doing more, and could they be doing more to reach out to residents, to black folks who have been living there for decades, if not generations? Shouldn't there be more of an effort?
Well, I think you saw some hiccups on that front, even with the golf event, where the union that works out of the Detroit Golf Club had some, you know, labor issues, like kind of right before the event happened. And then there was a situation with the Wayne County executive and his wife feeling like they were mistreated at the event. So
right.
I think at the very least, the African Americans who attend the event should be treated with respect. But yeah, I do think that there should be some more outreach. There's a woman I'm thinking of in Detroit named Selena Hollywood, who does golf lessons for Black children. So the extent that they can invest in those kind of things so that more African Americans can feel invested in the sport, you know, because as you said, a lot of deals get made there, a lot of jobs get solidified on the golf course. So, and you know, I'm just using golf as an example. The same thing kind of goes for the Grand Prix. Those of us who love the island, who ride our bikes, who walk, who just spend time on the island, a third of the island is pretty much cut off to us for a big chunk of the summer because of that race. And I think that with that kind of sacrifice that the people of Detroit are being asked to make, there certainly should be more outreach to make sure that not only just in the event so that more people, you know, regular people can attend the event, but that they are exposed to maybe auto racing as a career option. And I definitely think there should be more done to make sure ordinary Detroiters experience, not just the event, but, you know, kind of the opportunities that come with the event.
But how do we see those promises come to fruition? We do see often very moneyed interests come into the city, make grand promises to residents about jobs that will be provided and never really make good on it. And, you know, the argument can be made about where that stems from and why that is. But how do we ensure? Does it happen from a policy standpoint to ensure that jobs are created? Where does that push come from?
I think it has to come from our elected officials who make decisions about, particularly when you talk about the use of public land.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know that there was just a contract, I think, recently signed to extend the Grand Prix so that it would continue to be held at Belle Isle. I think there just has to be real accountability to make sure that, again, you know, there has to be exposure for the event so that ordinary Detroiters have access to the event. But then there also has to be these jobs that are being promised. And I don't think it should just be jobs for mounting that one event on, you know, one weekend in May or June. It has to be more of a long-term strategic effort to make sure that people are exposed to the long-range job opportunities. And I mean by young people who are making decisions about what they want to do when they grow up. Entertainment is a huge industry. And, you know, I think that these events are really a great opportunity. A lot of the growth that we are experiencing now, particularly with things like restaurants, you know, some of the retail offerings that we have, obviously they're going to be depending on Detroit, but those are also dependent on people outside of Detroit coming in and telling our story.
Right.
So to the extent that we can get people in here, so they can see, I mean, I'm near Livernois right now. I'm probably 5 minutes away from the Detroit Club at this very moment. And what you will find is there are a lot of new kind of neighborhood restaurants that are popping up.
Yeah.
And they're going to be sustained by the people who live here every day. But to the extent that someone who's coming in for an event like the Rocket Mortgage Classic can, you know, stop in at Cuzzo's or stop in at some of these other, you know, kind of establishments, I think it's a great thing.
And do you see there being an economic benefit as well? I mean, we place a lot of emphasis from a business perspective that there will be an economic boom. Do you see it as being something that maybe this would be such an exciting week would generate its own mini economy?
To be honest with you, I don't see it yet. Mm-hmm. I still think that it's in, you know, that event particularly is in its infancy. So it's still probably too soon to say. I did see that the city seemed to really kind of work to spruce up some of the buildings that are on the way to the golf club so that the streets look a little bit less empty. The, you know, some of the vacant properties were spruced up, and I think that's a good thing. I think to the extent that we can really work to actually get real businesses into those slots, particularly with that, you know, some of those areas that you have to drive through to get to the golf club, there are some of them are the most vibrant neighborhoods in Detroit, but then there are also some that need some tender loving care. So I think to the extent that we can redouble our efforts to make sure that those corridors look great and not just look great, but they actually are thriving. That will be the long-term spinoff that we can see from this. But I think when you're just talking about a weekend event where people can come in and get a taste of the city, that's good. But I think if the city redoubles its efforts to make sure that those areas get some attention so that those corridors look really great next year when folks are coming into the golf club, then it will have been worth it, because then beyond that weekend, you'll see kind of spin-off economic benefits. So those are the kind of things that I would like to see happen because of those events.
Well, Kim, before I let you go, I have to ask you, the circus is currently in town. We don't have to wait till next year. What do you want to hear out of these Dems?
I'm on the Wayne State Board, so the circus has been here for a while, but yes, okay, go ahead.
Well, as an elected official, I'm sure you have something you want to hear from the Democratic debate tonight. So what do you want to hear as an official, as a voter, and as a Detroiter?
So as an official, as a Democrat, I have to say, probably my number one priority for 2020 is making sure that the person who occupies the White House is gone. So I just want to make, one of the things I'm going to be paying very close attention to is how credible candidates are as a general election candidate. You know, so, you know, typically in a primary, people kind of veer to the left, and I would consider myself to be, you know, a progressive. So, you know, of course, those are the messages I want to hear, but I also want to be able to see that people can also pivot back so that they can capture enough votes that they can win the election, the general election. So that's what I'm looking for as an elected official. As a voter, one of the things that Andrew Yang, I think, has really made a point of talking about how we have to build a economy that is really kind of paying attention to the fact that, you know, AI and how automation is going to totally remake our economy. That's something that I'm really passionate about. That's why I'm on the Wayne State Board, is because I'm really passionate about making sure that people are educated so that we have the skills that will make us kind of robot-proof. I want to hear more candidates talking about that. Right now, I think he's the only one who really has turned a lot of attention to that. I think, you know, Donald Trump is talking about the old economy. He's talking about, oh, we're going to make sure people have jobs in coal mines, you know, industries that are going to die off on their own. Even if we didn't have attention to global warming or climate change, I want to see candidates who are willing to challenge people to say, okay, the future may be different, but you don't have to be afraid of it. Hmm. And here's what I'm going to do to make sure that we are properly prepared and that our folks are trained for those jobs of the future. You know, I come from a family that was built by the auto industry, so I'm very appreciative of that. But looking out into the future, we know that manufacturing and pretty much every industry is going to be fundamentally changed by automation and AI. So what are you going to do as President of the United States to make sure that people like my aunts and uncles and my brother who worked in the plant, who aren't at retirement age yet, what are they going to do when those jobs, because they don't have to necessarily disappear, but they will be changing. And how will you make sure that the government is has its eye on the ball on that? So that's something that's really important to me.
Well, Kim Trent, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Laura, for inviting me.
Coming up on Stateside, there's an overproduction of milk in Michigan.
You're basically chasing more production to make more money, which is thus depressing prices and making it harder for you to make money.
We'll talk about why that is and find out about the future of dairy in the state. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. You know, growing up, I always had a glass of milk with dinner. My parents...
I don't know anything as good as a glass of Borden's milk.
My brother...
Unless, of course, it's another glass of Borden's milk.
Right.
We all drank milk with our meals.
You know, every meal's the time for Borden's. Between meals, too.
Now, though...
Hey, Mom! Be sure to buy Borden's! Buy Borden's!
I give my kids water with our meals. And I guess I'm not the only one who isn't drinking as much milk, because there's actually an overproduction of milk in the state right now. It's driving down prices at the store, and it's forcing longtime dairy farmers to rethink their businesses, for themselves and for future generations. Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott visited Horning Farms in Manchester. He spoke with Caitlin Packard, and she's a sixth-generation dairy farmer.
So here in our milking parlor, we milk twice a day on our farm at 4 a.m. and 4 p.m. It takes us between 4 and 5 hours to milk the almost 400 cows.
That's cool. I feel like I'm obligated. Can we go see some cows?
Yes, most definitely.
Fantastic.
So if it's all right with you, we'll go see the baby calves before we go to see the cows.
That's totally fine. That's amazing.
So on our farm, we keep all of our calves in individual housing. They essentially, we call them hutches, but really they're giant dog houses is what they are.
They look like they got it made. They're just laying out here in the sun, chilling. That's really funny. So What's the dairy business like these days?
Not great.
If you don't mind me asking, is the farm in the black?
Right now we're in the black, but last year it was more like barely making it. Really, when it comes to looking at the economics of things, for any business, to grow the size, you increase your efficiencies by the economies of scale. It's a basic economic principle. If you're not able to do that when the prices aren't good, you got to differentiate yourself in some way. So we've discussed that we aren't really interested in becoming a larger farm at this point, but we've been discussing a lot of different options of ways that we can just create more income for ourselves that we have more control over, because creating that milk, that commodity, we have no control over the price.
So have you guys talked in detail about ideas for a niche market or rough ideas at this point? How what are those discussions like?
Pretty rough ideas right now. Yeah. It's pretty scary to try to jump into a new industry. So we've kind of been kicking around other ideas that we could use as a stepping stone. We've started raising some of our male cattle. Usually in the past, we'd always sold them to other farmers to raise for beef, and we've started raising some of them here ourselves to sell to people for their freezer. We've thrown around other ideas like our cooperative that we sell our milk through. They have a cheese processing plant. We've thrown around the idea of maybe offering that cheese here on farm. Another idea would be maybe even we have an old barn that maybe turn it into like a Airbnb or something like that. There's all kinds of ideas, but they're pretty rough right now. We haven't actually made any actual steps towards them.
Sure. You guys have been farming since 1877, or this farm's been here since 1877. Are you sentimental about that when you think about the future and how things might change?
Yeah, most definitely. That's something that that's always kind of in the back of my mind, is that I really enjoyed being raised on the farm. That was really great, and I would like my future kids someday to have that same opportunity. We're 140 plus years old and continue on for another 140 plus years. That would be awesome.
Totally.
That was Caitlin Packard of Horning Farms speaking with Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott. With us now is Dustin Walsh. He's a reporter with Crain's Detroit Business who recently wrote about the overproduction of milk in Michigan. Dustin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also with us is Jim Byram. He's president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. Jim, welcome to the program. All right, so Jim, let's start with you. Why are we seeing this overproduction of milk in the state?
There's three things that are really interesting about production of milk in the state of Michigan. First is the amount of milk that's produced per cow is significantly more than in the past. It's virtually double what it was 10 years ago. So cows are far more efficient. The production technologies have enabled more production to occur per cow. Secondly, the northern climates, Michigan in particular, Wisconsin, the northern climes are very attractive for milk production. Cows like cooler weather. They don't like hot weather. So Michigan actually, I think, is number three in production of milk per cow. Hmm. The other thing that happens is we have seen very large dairy operations get bigger. And cost efficiency in dairy production is a significant issue and really drives production.
Dustin, what else are there? What other contributing factors are there to overproduction?
Sure. So, I mean, we also have to look at the global view. Historically, the European Union had a quota on their production. They kept production low so prices would be high and therefore sustain farms in Europe. They lifted that quota some years back, and therefore they could produce as much milk as they wanted. And so that really depressed prices as well, as the EU started basically exporting all over the world their milk product, and it also depressed prices.
The other thing that's significant, Michigan has an abundance of feed. Well, in our feed stock here, corn in particular, we have some among the lowest farm gate prices for corn and soybeans of anywhere in the country. So milk production here is cheaper than it is in some other states.
Is there a role that alternative milk alternatives play in this equation? We were thinking of all the alternatives before we entered into this conversation. My co-producer and I were thinking of all the alternatives that exist out there. And, you know, people growing older claiming lactose intolerance also being an issue. What are those alternatives doing to the overall economic picture for milk?
Well, they're certainly hurting dairy demand, hurting milk demand from dairy cattle. You know, if you walk past a milk case today in a grocery store or a retail establishment, the irony is there's probably more non-dairy alternatives in terms of the number of SKUs in that case than there is of dairy alternatives,
right?
Which is really a fundamental shift in the market.
Dustin, when you were talking to farmers, did they think that the alternative milk products were playing into their overall issues?
I think it's a favorite punching bag for them. You know, it's like anything. It's this new competition. I think they're more upset that it's called milk and that it's on the shelves right next to milk when technically it's not milk. I think they see that, but I think the overall economic picture is more stark for them. But it's certainly fun for them to knock it because, you know, it does cut. And of course it cuts in people drinking almond milk and things like that.
Dustin's absolutely correct. I mean, the overall consumption of milk at a meal has dropped considerably. I mean, the number of glasses of milk that people drink today is down from what it used to be.
Is milk still American, Jim? I just picture my childhood, and I always had a glass of milk at the dinner table, and I felt like that was an image that was sort of foisted upon us from our parents' 1950s upbringings, 1940s, just this idea that it was this sort of, you know, this nuclear family that always had milk on the table. It doesn't seem like that's the case. It seems more that it would be trending towards water at this point would be with every meal. So do you still think that milk is sort of a part of the American diet in the way that it used to be?
If you're asking me my bias, yeah, I think it is. The challenge is I'm not sure consumers today, and I'm probably not representative of the consumer audience today, but frankly, you're absolutely right. It is shifting. It's a different approach to how food overall is selected, what people believe is healthy and what people want their kids, in the example you use, to consume. So we're seeing a fundamental shift, as I say, in that demand structure, and you identified one of the core constituencies.
Dustin, you spoke with farmers who are rethinking their business in general, and they're retooling to something completely different. What alternatives are they considering, or are they mostly just selling their cattle off?
Well, I think it depends where you're located. One of the farmers I spoke with was in Manchester, so, you know, close to Ann Arbor. So the way they viewed it is Ann Arbor is getting, you know, as suburbanization continues, the suburban sprawl, they see Ann Arbor getting closer every day. To them, it's this farm to table. What can we do to capitalize on, the yuppies in Ann Arbor that want to experience something down home, old school 1950s, whatever it is. So they're looking at agritourism. So what kind of tours can we do? And you know, you have children. We go to the pumpkin patch, which used to be you just pick up a pumpkin. Now it's got games. It's got, I mean,
cider.
The whole thing, anything to get your dollar. So a lot of the dairy farmers are looking at that same sort of model. What can we do? Can we turn this old barn into an Airbnb? You know, hey, do you want to come pay money and work on a farm just like ranchers did out west? You know, come work on a ranch for a week.
Milk a cow.
and, you know, what can we do to cut out the middleman as well? What can we do to cut out the distribution? Do we sell direct? Do we make our own cheese? Anything to kind of, you know, basically boost margins is really what they're all looking at. And again, what it comes down to, it's very difficult because these are all family-run businesses mostly. And they're trying to figure out, do they have that skill set? Can they learn that skill set? You know, something they've been doing. Well, something they've been doing for a century in the family, and then all of a sudden flipping a switch and doing something completely different.
Jim, are you hearing a trend in that direction among your members? Are there more and more farmers who are considering other ways to present their industry to the public?
There's no question about it. I mean, we can identify several that are looking at unique approaches to market, whether it's agritourism is what people call it today, with those experiences on the farm, whether it's even switching to organic production, which has been a major trend. Looking at unique production and trying to identify local, there's more and more dairy operations trying to figure out how to produce artisan cheese or whatever it may be.
Right.
The irony is, while that trend moves forward, the other trend of big dairies getting bigger continues as well.
Where is the shift here? Because to me, the thing that was most widely available in the 80s and 90s would have been the Kroger milk that would have come from a mass-produced location, not the artisan milks, if you will.
Well, it used to be in the state of Michigan or around the country, virtually every small town, every significant small town had a dairy processing facility. Mm. There were tons of them in Michigan, dozens and dozens. As food safety became a bigger issue, as volume and economic realities hit some of those operations, both of those factors had a significant impact on the erosion of some of those smaller processors, to the point that we have some very, very large processors in Michigan today. In fact, a new one being built in St. John's.
That's right.
That demand just huge volumes of milk. And it's going to actually suck up some of that overproduction that we have currently in the state, to the point that some of the large dairy operations are actually thinking about expanding again, even though the price of milk hasn't rebounded considerably to help out those producers.
Dustin, of the farmers you spoke with, what do they sort of view as the future for their business and for their families?
something completely different than it looks like today. I think most of them want to hold, I mean, they all want to hold on to what they have. But the idea is that as families get larger, you have kids, grandkids, you're supporting more families on the same amount of money. I talked to one farmer, they dug out their old milk checks, and they said they're making the exact same amount of money now as they were making in the 1970s.
Wow.
So as you have kids, grandkids, and you have more people, and you potentially have more kids wanting to work on the farm, you have to figure out a way to increase your profits.
And it's a real frustration. Totally agree. I mean, farmers or farming in many ways is a lifestyle.
Right.
And they like to bring kids back and grandkids back and farm, and it's bred in their genes. They like to farm. The challenge is agriculture also doesn't necessarily like to change a whole lot. But if you look at the economics and the reality and consumer demand is driving all of this, is fundamentally changing around the world.
I wonder if this is a marketing issue. Is it possible that the milk industry on a small scale can reconvince Americans that this is the drink that should be at their table? There's so many health benefits that can be reaped by from drinking milk. And maybe some people wanted to cut it out for health reasons specifically. But, you know, the sugar industry has done an incredible job convincing us that we cannot live without sugar. So is there potentially a marketing solution here?
Marketing is the key to everything. Market determinations or marketing decisions. I mean, I look at the whole RBST. Added RBST was eliminated from dairy production purely as a marketing issue. The irony is all milk produced has BST. But eliminating RBST was a marketing decision. Looking at organic is, in many ways, certainly folks believe in the benefits of organic, and that's great for those that ascribe to that. The challenge is, in many ways, a lot of decisions people are making are based on marketing claims and marketing determinations. That is absolutely the real case.
And Dustin, is there a way that some of these farmers have discussed banding together to strike at the issue with consumers in their areas, or are they already doing pretty much everything they can?
Most of the local farmers, your small mom and pop type farmers, are already part of a co-op that distributes the milk. I'm not sure what they could do to change the economic outlook of this, because it's not something that's regional. You know, it's not like, okay, in Southeast Michigan, we're having this milk issue. I mean, this is a global issue. I mean, you know, it's all over the world, and we've chased globalization to a point where, you know, it is where it's at. And I don't see how you reverse it, even with the best marketing campaign on earth, I don't think can reverse this. So I think you're going to see a lot more farms and them accept the reality that these dairy farms are going to become petting farms. They're going to have ball tosses and corn pits and all the things that when we go up north, we seek out to take our kids to, because that's a more controlled environment for them. They don't have to worry about outside global economics that are so far and above their ability to influence.
You talked about them, you know, looking at these checks from the 1970s, and they are making the same amount of money they were 40 years ago. Is there a frustration and a disdain for what's happened, and they're just ready to get out? Or is it more mournful? Are they sad that this is not going to be something available for their kids and grandkids to pursue as an industry?
All of the above. I mean, I think it depends what they're doing. I talked to one farmer that, you know, they realized it was a no-go, but they had kids that were in the business with them, 20-some-year-old children, I guess grown adults at that point. So to keep it alive, they found a large farmer, one of these more corporate-style dairy farms, and they worked out a deal where they take care of their pregnant cows. They call them dry cows. They take care of their dry cows, and they send them back to the big farm when they're ready to be milked, and they take care of the calves. They now have a boss, which I think is the hardest part for them. But that was a way for them to sustain their lifestyle and to sustain the farm that's been in their family for more than 100 years.
And is that sustainable for them well into the future? Or
I think that's an avenue that we might see more of as these big corporate-style farms look for efficiencies. They can offload some of what they're doing to maybe some of these smaller farms. You know, these are not people that just got into the industry. These are people that have been doing farming for hundreds of years. So they know how to take care of these animals for these people. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that, particularly as these larger farms want to get larger. So I think it's going to obviously matter how close you are to these big farms. But yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it that there are farms that are going away, and then that lifestyle is going away with it. And of course, I mean, if you look at the suicide rates among farmers, are incredibly high. People are not happy about this. People are obviously sad that that lifestyle that their family has enjoyed for as far as they can remember is going away and gone in many cases.
Jim, Dustin, one of the more alarming parts of Dustin's story included a segment where farmers were being asked to check on their neighbors to make sure that they had not ended their own lives. Is that something that is really discussed frequently among your members or your colleagues?
We discuss it more and more, and it's not limited to the dairy industry. I mean, the uncertainty in trade, the uncertainty of commodity prices, corn, soybeans, wheat, et cetera, certainly the dairy industry, but really it's every segment, and it's an economically driven phenomenon that's devastating in communities. We started seeing an uptick in that situation probably 3 or 4 years ago, and it's not something that's pervasive, but it's something we're all aware of and want to make sure that we do everything possible to address it. I know the Extension Service of Michigan State has programs to deal with it. The Department of Agriculture is kicking off programs to deal with
depression among farmers. Yeah,
absolutely. Depression among farmers and the ultimate suicide issue. It's huge. It's an embarrassment. Because it's a lifestyle. It's what they've always done. They have a farm that's been in the family for 100 years and they weren't successful. And it's really devastating and causes all sorts of issues with the psyche.
Jim Byram and Dustin Walsh, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be with you. Agriculture is a changing industry.
Coming up next, we'll continue our look at the future of dairy by talking to a cheesemaker who's rethinking her business.
Basically, no milk, no cheese. So good milk and plenty of it is the only way to run a cheesemaking business.
And we'll talk about the stress this changing industry places on farmers. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Anne and John Hoyt have a cheesy relationship. No, really. They make artisan cheese together and co-own Lilanois Cheese. Anne is from France and John is from Detroit, and they met on a dairy farm in Switzerland. Now they make cheese together in northern Michigan. But the changing dairy industry nearly forced them to close their popular business. I read about it recently in the Glen Arbor Sun. Anne and John recently decided that they would retool and stay open. And I asked her just how important is milk to her business.
Okay, milk is your number one ingredient in your cheese, in your cheese making in general, and basically no milk, no cheese. So good milk and plenty of it is the only way to run a cheese making business.
And in this article where I originally saw your story, I saw there were at least four, maybe a half dozen different dairy farmers in your area who have closed down in recent years. This, I imagine, has made it more difficult for you to have a one-on-one relationship with the dairy farmer that you were working with.
When we started here, Lilanois County used to be, a little bit more of a dairy industry. When we came to Lilanois County, there was just a handful left of dairy farms, and it was in the early 90s. You know, it was just fine, and those at least five dairy farms, and we had the choice of picking up milk and going to different dairy farms as long as the farmer was willing to work with us. And in the last, I'm going to say it started at least a good 5-6 years ago, the price of milk started to go down and down, and it's starting getting harder and harder for the farmers to make a living. And also, not only the price of the milk, but up here, one of the big problems is finding help, any kind of help to either to work on a farm or to work with us in the creamery. And so when it comes to the point of you have nobody to help you, and you are also barely making any money, you just choose to switch or close your business, and that's what happened with the dairy farms here. Dairy farming is very labor intensive,
right.
And they all choose to close their farms and switch to meat. Hmm. Actually, they still have cows, but they now go in the beef industry instead of milk.
How many gallons of milk do you use every week?
Every time we make a batch of cheese, we use about 400 gallons of milk.
Wow. So it's a little bit more complicated than just going to the grocery store in Traverse City and picking up a bunch of gallons of milk. You really do have to have a one-on-one relationship.
Yeah, we go to the dairy farm. My husband is a licensed bulk milk hauler.
Hmm.
You have to be licensed to pick up milk at a dairy farm. And, this is... And we get the milk raw, and we take care of everything. We do all of the tests and pasteurization and everything here. I mean, it's the...
Okay. So you're picking it up before it goes to a processor as well?
Before, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we have a small truck. We have a milk truck called... we named the Milky Way. We actually go to the dairy farm before the very big truck comes, because that dairy farmer produces a lot more than 400 gallons. But yes, we have to get the milk before they come.
And so, Anne, I'm happy to hear that you are keeping your business open, at least for the foreseeable future. Is there some point where you would have to retool and think again about whether or not it was worth carrying on?
Well, at that point, I think we are very happy with that decision. We are reinventing the Lilano cheese wheel and doing something a little bit different. So breaking our routine, but staying in business, staying open, and keep making cheese. And I really want to see our place, our little location here on M22, stay in the food industry and not becoming a brewery or winery, which is, you know, we already have so many now in Lilano County. So far with that idea, this is very positive, and we can keep moving forward. I think there's a lot of good things that might happen here with Lilano Cheese, and the idea of not closing is also to help us figure out what the future is going to be.
Well, Anne Hoyt, as somebody who loves to consume cheese more than I drink beer, keep it coming.
We will. Power to a cheese.
Anne Hoyt is the co-owner of Lilano Cheese. Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day and keep eating cheese.
Anne and John made a big decision to stay open, but they're also facing an uncertain future. That's the case for farmers and the agricultural industry throughout the state. As we heard earlier in the program, there are high rates of depression and suicide among farmers. This led the Michigan State University Extension to start a behavioral health program for farmers. Jeffrey Dwyer is the director of the Michigan State University Extension. Jeffrey Dwyer, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Please explain a little bit about why we're seeing these levels of stress among farmers.
Right. So in many ways, I think we're in a time period here that could be characterized as a sort of perfect storm of stressors. But I think we also need to remember that farming and agriculture has always been full of risks in many respects. And so it's an occupation, for example, that has high injury rates. It's an occupation that is subject to tariffs, to trade policies, to lots of other things, including commodity prices. And in areas like dairy, we've seen very low commodity prices for a few years now, and we expect that to continue. And then you add on to that the difficulty of the weather that we've experienced in recent months. And it just puts the nature of the stressors and the risks that farmers face really at a level that we become increasingly concerned about making sure we get them the resources and the help we can.
It's interesting because on one hand, I would think of farming as being quite gratifying in that you probably spend a lot of time outside. There's a lot of manual labor, which can be very gratifying, and you're turning out ostensibly a product of some sort, and that can be very gratifying. But then on the other hand, there's an incredible amount of year over year anxiety because you're not sure what any given growing season, or if you have livestock, you might not be sure what any given season is going to bring to the plate, essentially.
Well, I think you're right on target there, and I don't want to minimize that it is gratifying for people, and it is terrific to be outdoors, and When I talk to farmers and those in agriculture, as I had the opportunity again to do just yesterday in the middle part of the state, they are very proud of what they do and they want to be doing it. And yet, I also drive 30 to 40,000 miles a year in my role as director of Michigan State University Extension. And I see farmers out in the field well after dark, sometimes at midnight with lights on their tractors, trying to harvest or trying to plant. I see milk barns lit up at 2 a.m. As people are trying to do that third milking. And so it's very difficult. And I think that one of the things we don't think about, and yet you just pointed to very accurately, the risks year over year, financially and otherwise, are tremendous, but sometimes even within the year. And so I was talking to a farmer a couple of months ago, a row crop farmer, meaning corn, beans, soybeans, that sort of thing. And he said something that I think was very profound. He's a small farmer. He and his wife farm 2,000 acres by themselves. And his point was, you know, Jeff, I'm going to put $500,000 in the ground in the next few weeks, and I really have no control over what's going to happen. And I think when we think of it in those terms, we gain a greater appreciation for the full range of risks and stressors that farming and farmers face today.
It's a huge gamble.
Yes.
So how does this stress manifest for the farmers that you're speaking with? What does stress sound like and look like to these farmers?
I think one of the ways that stress manifests that we're concerned about is increases in recent years in attempted suicides and completed suicides among farmers. Farmers and farm workers attempt and complete suicide at much higher rates than the general population. So that's certainly one thing we think about. I think that we also see the impact of these stressors in family dynamics and in professional working relationships on the farm. And so we've worked with families, three and four generation families, for example, that have for their lifetimes worked together, but they're finding the conditions under which they're now having to work financially and dealing with weather and trade and all of those sorts of things is increasingly difficult. And it's also difficult in that generational context in the sense that many older generations hope that their farms will be taken on by the subsequent generations. Sometimes there are younger generations interested and sometimes not. But in both instances, it's a matter of figuring out how to make that work for everyone financially and how to make the transitions and those sorts of things. We're also seeing it, for example, this year with the weather and everything, issues around the timing of planting and the fact that we had many that ultimately had to make the decision to not plant. But then those that got things in the ground much later than expected. And at that point, they had to be considering time to harvest. They had to be considering weather projections, but they also had to be considering things that I think most of us wouldn't even consider, which is they have to think about crop insurance. And when is that crop insurance likely to help them? And when might it not? And how does that relate to decisions around whether to plant or not to plant?
Does the availability of crop insurance help reduce stress among farmers, especially for these particularly wet seasons that we've seen?
Yeah, so I think that the availability per se doesn't create the stress, but what a lot of people don't realize is that, first of all, there's the decision about whether to obtain crop insurance or not. And mm-hmm. that's like anyone makes a decision about
whether insurance. To spend some money. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, right. That's not otherwise mandated. But what most of us don't know about crop insurance is there is a date by which your seed has to be in the ground to have the potential to get the 100% payoff if there's a failure. And anytime you then the days and weeks subsequent to that deadline, you get a reduced payoff, even if you have a total loss. And that just becomes part of the business calculation.
Right. You might get a 50% yield. So then you have to make a decision. Am I willing to risk only getting that 50% or do I need the insurance and potentially cover all of it and not plant? Yeah, that's a tricky equation to navigate, I would imagine, for just about everybody.
Yes, it is. It's very complicated. Farmers are among the most sophisticated business people I've ever come across in my professional life.
We spoke with a reporter who interviewed farmers who, when they are speaking with people such as yourself, they are asked to check on their neighbors to make sure that they have not, in fact, ended their own lives. That alone seems like a stress that would add to somebody's life, let alone the business that they're struggling with. They also are probably worried about their friends and their community. And I imagine you probably run into people who are facing depression, thinking about other people being depressed.
Well, it's a very good point. And you know, when I talk publicly about this, one of the things I point out is, you know, farmers and those in agriculture are people too. That means they're subject to life stress, anxiety, depression, just like the rest of us. I think the thing we've been especially attuned to in recent years in MSU Extension and programming that we've developed around this, one program called Communicating with Farmers Under Stress that we've offered and have provided to more than 1,500 individuals who work in agriculture, but also a second area of programming called Weathering the Storm, How to Cultivate a Productive Mind that we offer directly to farmers and farm families, is all about really three things that become very important. One is signs and symptoms of depression, of anxiety, of stress, and certainly of people who may be under immense distress and may need some immediate intervention. Secondly, how to communicate with people, friends, family, maybe that, you know, this doesn't come easy to any of us. So if we recognize signs and symptoms that we should be concerned about, what are some communication tools that we might use just to open a conversation and make sure that they're okay, or help them if we can? And then third, so that people know some basic avenues through which to refer and gain professional help if they need it. And so what we've tried to do in our programming to directly address the issue that you raise is that I think we all own this, in that it's not just farmers and those in agriculture who need to be concerned about this. We all need to be concerned about this. If you have a friend, a neighbor, a family member that you know always to be clean shaven and well kept, or always on time for meetings or appointments, and those things have started to change, might be worth just a conversation, check in with them, make sure they're okay.
Well, Jeffrey, you're dealing with essentially the patient once they've reached the hospital. How do we prevent the need for the hospital in the first place? Is there something that we can be tackling on the front end that prevents these levels of stress and depression we see?
Right. So I think honestly, some of them are a little hard to control. Commodity prices, for example, trade imbalances in Central Asia that in a secondary or tertiary fashion, you know, impact trade in Michigan. Some of those things are a little harder for us to directly impact. But I think what we can do is to become aware of the importance of the issue, become aware of the significant role that farmers, farm families, and agriculture plays in our state, and really take on the understanding that we all have a responsibility here, and to reach out wherever possible. I can tell you just a quick little story that to me applies here, which is when we first started working in this area of behavioral health, especially in agriculture, was not something that we have traditionally been involved in. And we really got started about 3 years ago as we began to see this perfect storm develop. And one of our own agriculture educators was very adamant that this was not the right role for MSU Extension, that no one would come to sessions, that people just would not respond to this. And yet, to his credit, he helped us organize a couple of the early sessions. And in one of those community sessions where we were doing some of this training directly to farmers and farm families, a longtime farmer was sitting next to him. And about halfway through the program, this older gentleman leaned over to my colleague and said, "Where has this been all this time? I need this and we need this." And what's interesting about that was it was a recognition on both their parts that just because we hadn't tackled it in this way before didn't mean that it wasn't necessary.
Right, sure.
More important, and I think that what gets right to your question, in that part of the state, that gentleman is now a part of a small group of farmers in that county that meet independently about once a month, simply to talk, check in with each other, communicate, express support to each other. And I think that's very important too, because, you know, one of the things we need to remember is that there remain, importantly, many small and family farms in Michigan. And so at certain times of the year, it can become very isolating because there's just a lot of work to do and you're in the tractor by yourself or you're in the barn by yourself. And I think the basic communication, the frequent opportunity to engage with others is a big part of what we can all do as well.
Jeffrey Dwyer is the director of the Michigan State University Extension and the Senior Associate Dean of Outreach and Engagement for the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at Michigan State University. He joins us today from the Upper Peninsula. Jeffrey, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
That'll do it for today. Tomorrow on the program, we will recap the first night of the Democratic debates in Detroit. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.